Service. Ethics. Advocacy. Welcome to the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. The Tax Center provides guidance, information, and tax practice tools to support the three goals of the AICPA Tax Section Strategic Plan: practice support, professional standards and ethics, and Washington representation. The AICPA Tax Section Podcast is one more source of information on all things tax and tax-related. In this episode, William Stromson, Director of the AICPA Tax Division, will discuss current developments in tax law and practice.
Hello, this is Bill Stromson, a director with the AICPA Tax Team, with the Tax Section Audio Alert for August 14, 2009. These podcasts are based on email alerts that AICPA Tax Section members receive and that include hot links to the source materials that I'll refer to in this audio version. Please consider joining the Tax Section to take full advantage of our practice alerts. You can do so online at aicpa.org/tax. Today I'm going to cover a variety of issues: we'll pay for healthcare reform, some issues on LLC, LLP owners and passive losses, the cash for clunkers bill, and a number of other provisions. This should take about 25 minutes, so here we go with some tax news you can use. Paying for healthcare reform. The House Ways and Means Committee has voted a $1 trillion revenue package over the next 10 years to pay for healthcare. The legislation is still developing, and you're probably reading a lot about it in the news and seeing it on TV, complete with food fights. On the 17th of July, the Ways and Means Committee passed the following recommendations. Here's a quick summary. There'll be a tax surcharge on individuals who earn more than $350,000. That would start at 1%, but increase to 5.4% for those with modified adjusted gross income that exceeds $1 million. There'd be a non-compliance tax imposed on individuals that do not acquire acceptable health insurance for themselves and their families. Each individual will be required to maintain that package or be subject to an additional 2.5% of adjusted gross income tax effective after December 31st, 2012. There's also a non-compliance tax on employers who don't provide employees health coverage. Employers can elect not to provide that, but then they have to pay an additional payroll tax equal to 8% of gross wages. This would be a separate one from Social Security with no wage-based limitations. There's a small business exception, and small is really small in this case. It's for employers with payrolls of less than $400,000. There's a tax credit available to small employers for providing health insurance coverage. Another provision would affect health savings accounts, flexible spending accounts, health reimbursement accounts, Archer medical savings accounts, and would deny reimbursement for over-the-counter medication such as aspirin, things like that. One item of particular interest in this bill is that it would codify the economic substance doctrine by defining the economic substance rule, which courts have used to determine when tax avoidance efforts would be considered abusive. The proposal includes new penalties for underpayments attributable to transactions that lack economic substance. The AICPA opposed this continuously because we think by codifying it, you lose some of the flexibility that helps the courts enforce this important concept, which may not be as easy to enforce if you have things locked up in legislative language. Hey, when healthcare legislation passes, we'll get back with you with the details. Here's some information on LLP and LLC members. Generally, it was thought that limited liability owners did not materially participate in a business and that deductions were limited by passive loss rules. A couple of recent cases have held otherwise. In Paul and Alicia Garrett versus the Commissioner and James R. Thompson versus the United States, courts have ruled that LLC and LLP partners were not limited partners for passive activity loss limitation purposes. According to the cases, The regs do not treat the owners as limited partners for purposes of Section 469H2, the presumption that limited partners do not materially participate in an activity. Both courts agreed that the service was wrong to focus attention on limited liability as the determining characteristic of whether an entity is subject to this presumptive passive activity limitation. The courts indicated that rather than limited liability, material participation was the central theme behind congressional enactment of the rules, and thus the IRS could not deem LLC and LLP owners to be a limited partner simply because all three of these entities have limited liability. Accordingly, the courts agree that LLC and LLP partners are not barred from establishing material participation under the traditional seven-prong statutory test. Tax and clunkers. The Consumer Assistance to Recycle and Save Act of 2009, that the acronym is CARS, and it's more commonly known as Cash for Clunkers. It became effective July 23rd, and I'm sure you've seen it in the news, but there's some interesting tax implications that haven't been very well covered. For individuals, the rebate is tax exempt, but there's no exemption for auto dealers who must include the rebate as part of the purchase price and therefore part of their gross income. The dealer can deduct the cost of implementing and maintaining this rebate program. As to sales tax on the rebate, the states are divided as to whether the consumer has to pay and the dealer has to collect taxes on the rebate amount. It's interesting, some neighboring states have come up with direct opposite views on that, giving a few hundred dollars benefit of going just across the border and purchasing in another state where they don't tax the rebate as part of the sales price. Speaking of clunkers, how about Chinese drywall? For those of you in states of Louisiana, Florida, South Carolina, California, and maybe 10 other states, there are over 100,000 homes that were built mostly between 2004 and 2006 with defective drywall manufactured in China. In heat and humidity, sulfur gas is released, and this can cause a rotten egg or ammonia odor that has made homeowners sick and can even corrode copper pipes and wires. But does this deterioration of the drywall give rise to a casualty loss deduction? Remember that rot and rust don't qualify. In a letter to congressional representatives in the affected states, though, an IRS associate chief counsel said damage from the drywall results from an identifiable event that is sudden, unexpected, and unusual, meeting the requirements of Section 165H. The letter doesn't address a measure of the decline in value, but the obvious starting point might be the cost of removing the old drywall and replacing it. We've been covering FBAR, that's foreign bank account reporting requirements, for quite a while here, and there's a lot of material on our website, so I'll just cover a little bit here. There have been some recent updates in the FBAR questions on the IRS website dealing with what is a financial account, what U.S. persons are involved, what are the filing requirements. And one item in the recent frequently asked questions that were published asks, if a U.S. person holds a partnership interest in a hedge fund that is located in the United States but that owns foreign financial accounts, must the U.S. person report his interest in a hedge fund on an FBAR, assuming the U.S. person does not hold more than 50% partnership interest in the hedge fund? The answer is something that people have been wrestling with, but the IRS has now said the answer is no. Also, there's a new form to apply for offshore voluntary compliance program in case you have not been complying with the FBAR reporting rules and have foreign bank accounts that haven't been disclosed. There's a form letter and a form and letter on the IRS website for voluntary disclosure. This has to be filed by September 23rd, 2009. For those of you who are totally confused about FBAR and voluntary compliance rules, we're holding a teleconference with the American Bar Association on August 20th at 11 a.m. East Coast time. A panel of experts will brief you on the issues and take your questions. The cost is $20 after a $10 tax section discount. This is being administered by the ABA, so to register, go online to abanet.org, and you'll be able to find the registration for this program. The IRS has suspended collection of the 6707A penalty. This is a tax shelter penalty provision that contains both transactions that have to be disclosed and also listed transactions. In a letter to House Ways and Means Committee member John Lewis, the IRS commissioner, Commissioner Shulman, said that the IRS will not collect the penalty through September 30th on transactions that have benefits of less than $100,000 for individuals and $200,000 for other taxpayers. In the meantime, the IRS hopes that legislation will be passed that will remedy the disproportionate application of this penalty. Penalty can be pretty harsh, $10,000 for a reportable transaction and $100,000 for listed transactions for individuals. And for other taxpayers, those figures are $50,000 and $200,000. The penalty could even apply, here's a fairly rotten case, where a taxpayer in good faith for the first time reports a transaction on a return or in a filing with the Office of Tax Shelter Analysis, but not in both places as is required. So they've made a defective disclosure. Here, the taxpayer attempted to comply, but would get the same penalty as the taxpayer who had intentionally not disclosed the transaction. Here's an interesting piece of information that's come to light recently on the taxation of gain from the sale of precious metals held in an exchange-traded fund. Generally, exchange-traded funds provide a useful alternative means of diversifying investments into areas that aren't otherwise as conveniently available, such as commodities, foreign stocks, real estate, currencies, and specialized industry investments. ETFs are taxed similar to mutual funds, with the gains generally being taxed at the maximum capital gains rate where it applies of 15%. So that would be your normal maximum tax that you'd pay on capital gains for the sale of an ETF. However, there's a trap here. Some ETFs invest in precious metals or futures, and while this can provide a helpful hedge against inflation and currency fluctuations, taxpayers need to be aware that the IRS treats this as an investment in a collectible, with gains taxed at a 28% maximum capital gains rate, which applies to collectibles. This tax treatment can be avoided by using some more sophisticated techniques, investing in precious metal futures contracts, and some other techniques that are just a little too broad for this audio alert. Hopefully our clients who are sophisticated enough to invest in precious metals will plan their investments after consulting us. The IRS has sent out some incorrect notices to charitable trusts, and we finally got this resolved, but basically some taxpayers received a CP 259 notice. That's a request for a tax return, and this generally looks like it came as a result of an IRS programming error regarding the failure to file Form 1041A for 2007 when it was no longer required to be filed. Beginning that year, Form 5227 was revised to incorporate the Form 1041A for split interest trusts. So at that point, charitable and remainder trusts, charitable lead trusts, and pooled income funds were no longer required to file the form. We brought this to the attention of the IRS, and they've talked to their service centers and processors, and there's going to be an apology to people and clarification that this is not a required form any longer. The IRS has provided some good guidance on accelerated alternative minimum tax and research credits versus bonus depreciation in Rev Proc 2009-33, and this is available on the IRS.gov website. It provides guidance on accelerating AMT and research credits in lieu of bonus depreciation. The new revenue procedure provides information on the time and manner for making the election, on which properties are eligible for the election, and on how to compute the amount of the additional credits. The American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009 had extended the additional first-year depreciation allowance through 2009. Under prior rules, businesses not able to take full advantage of the benefits of the additional first-year depreciation allowance were permitted to convert some of these depreciation allowances into additional AMT and research credits. The Act extended the special rule, and that goes for property placed in service before January 1st, 2010. The IRS has added some questions and answers to its website for the COBRA continuation premiums. Remember that last year's we were dealing with a lot of layoffs and people faced with expensive COBRA health insurance, that Congress said, hey, employers, you should pay this and then claim a credit on your employment tax forms for the amount that you pay in additional COBRA continuation coverage. The employer and the employee shared in the cost, with the employer picking up a good chunk of it. There were some problems, though, where employers had cut back pretty severely in their employees and didn't really have enough payroll taxes to cover the cost of their COBRA coverage. Well, the FAQs cover eligibility, form preparation, reporting and documentation, and taxability of the benefits. For more information, go check out the Frequently Asked Questions on the IRS website. You can pay your taxes using a credit or debit card, but you have to pay an additional convenience fee because Internal Revenue Code Section 6311D prohibits financial institutions from charging these to the IRS, and credit card companies aren't going to eat it. Previously, these were thought to be non-deductible, and that's the way the IRS was treating them. But in a recently released IRS Chief Counsel memorandum, the IRS changed its position to allow taxpayers to deduct convenience fees charged by financial institutions when paying taxes electronically with credit or debit cards. Convenience fees will still be limited in deductibility because they're treated as non-business expenses under Section 212, meaning that they're subject to the 2% floor in miscellaneous itemized deductions. However, this change may encourage some taxpayers to pay electronically and maybe earn some additional frequent flyer miles in the process. There's a kind of an old piece of legislation that's developing up as a problem for CPAs. In 2003, Congress passed legislation to curb identity theft, and the FTC subsequently issued what's called a red flag rule that requires creditors or financial institutions with creditor accounts to have in place a program to assist in identifying potential identity theft. CPAs could become subject to the FTC's red flag rules since recent interpretations from the FTC and to extend this to professional organizations, including lawyers and physicians. These could be so because a creditor includes, quote, any entity that defers payments even in the normal course of traditional billing process. Thus, if a CPA bills clients monthly, this could be considered an extension of credit that would require the CPA to have an internal program subject to inspection and review that is designed to detect, prevent, and mitigate identity theft. We've been seeking an exemption for CPAs, and in the meantime, the effective date has been deferred until November 1, 2009. This is all too painfully reminiscent of another unnecessary regulation that the FTC applied against CPAs. That's the Gramm-Leach-Bliley privacy notification requirements that the AICPA successfully fought to get out from under several years ago. We'll keep you apprised of developments. Additional information on the red flag rule can be found on the FTC website. There's a nice new private letter ruling out on tool reimbursement plans. PLR 2009-300-29, that letter ruling provides details as to how a business can construct a tool reimbursement plan that qualifies as an accountable plan arrangement so that reimbursements aren't taxable to the employee. Also, they would not be subject to employer and employee employment tax withholding. Tool reimbursement arrangements are common in certain industries, such as automotive, construction, and various industries that require specialized testing and other tools. In the past, the IRS has found all kinds of ways not to allow these plans, mostly because they're based on statistical sampling of annual expenses without requiring any documentation on the part of the employee. For the arrangement to qualify, this is reversed. There has to be a business connection between the amount reimbursed and the performance of services by the employee. The employee must substantiate the expenses, and the employee must return any excess expenses within a reasonable period. The PLR, it's not on the IRS website yet, but if you look around on the internet, you can probably find it. Hit that Google. Oh, we have some good tax section member benefits I want to tell you about. There's a $100 discount on a couple of good conferences. That's the AICP National Conference on Federal Taxes and the SIDCAST Sophisticated Tax Planning for Wealthy Clients. To register or get more information, go to cpatobiz.com. Be sure to log in so that you'll be recognized as a tax section member and get this $100 discount. Let's step back for a minute, give you a few more items that are of current news you can use. The IRS has recently released some frequently asked questions on the timing of extensions for individuals, partnerships, and corporate returns when a regional or local community is declared a federal disaster area. That's on their website. The Andover Submission Processing Center has been closed, and returns need to be sent to a new mailing address, also on the IRS website. There's an interesting item that just came out. The IRS National Taxpayer Advocate, Nina Olson, has released her mid-year report to Congress. This identifies her priority issues for the upcoming fiscal year and gives a good key to what the Congress may be taking a look at in terms of making changes to the IRS. Key issues focused on in her report were improvements by the service in taxpayer services, strengthening the agency's oversight of federal tax return preparers, making the offer and compromise program more accessible, and working with the IRS to improve administration of various refundable credits. The report contains analyses and statistical information on these issues and should be of interest to practitioners. In representing your interest before Congress and the IRS, the AICP has submitted simplification and fairness legislative proposals on July 1, 2009. It's a compendium of legislative proposals to correct a number of perceived technical problems and to simplify existing provisions. It was limited to proposals that are not unduly controversial and that promote simplicity and fairness. There are a variety of good issues covered in here, such as harmonizing and simplifying education incentives, simplifying the kiddie tax, standardizing mileage rates, removing cell phones and other PDAs from the classification of listed properties, and so forth. In the procedural area, we support repeal of the 20% partial payment requirement for a lump sum offer and compromise, and a grant of reasonable cause, good faith exception for the 6707A penalty. We have a survey online at our website with respect to Form 5471 information return of U.S. persons with respect to certain foreign corporations. We ask you to go on there if you have client experience here. A 15-question survey will collect information and not be attributable to any individual taxpayer, will be kept confidential as well. As we reported earlier, effective January 1, 2009, the IRS started automatically assessing a $10,000 penalty for each late-filed Form 5471 and also late-filing penalties related to Form 1120, even if there was no tax due. Go to the tax section website for a little more information on this. In the representation area, the AICP has also appeared at an IRS Prepare Review Forum. This forum comes out of the commissioner's effort to take a look at practitioner ethics. Our chairman of the IRS Practice and Procedures Committee, Mike Dolan, said that the service already has sufficient authority to regulate federal tax return preparers without the need for an additional legislative grant of authority. He also encouraged the IRS to avoid adding regulatory burdens to CPAs who are already regulated by state boards. And if the service starts to implement a new regulation program, they ought to consider what regulations are already in place on professionals. We would like for there to be additional regulation on unregulated commercial preparers, but we hope that CPAs won't have to be subject to additional unnecessary regulation. Well, that's it. Thanks for getting together, and let's do it again in 2 weeks. Bye-bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the AICPA Tax Section Podcast. Join the tax section and receive emailed alerts with links to many of the source documents referenced in this podcast. Be sure to tune in next time for even more coverage of all things tax and tax related.
This podcast is designed to provide illustrative information with respect to the subject matter covered and does not represent an official opinion or position of the AICPA. It is provided with the understanding that the AICPA is not engaged in rendering legal, accounting, or other professional services. If such advice or expert assistance is required, the services of a competent professional person should be sought. The AICPA makes no representations, warranties, or guarantees as to, and assumes no responsibility for, the content or application of the material contained herein, and expressly disclaims all liability for such damages arising out of the use of, reference to, or reliance on such material.